Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckabilies, what the fucking ears, what the fucking knots? Hi, it's Mark Maron. How are you? Are you okay? Everything good? Are you running? Are you driving? Are you on the train? Are you at home cooking or cleaning? I hope it's going okay. I don't know how you're listening to this or where you're listening to it. I just talked to somebody who I met at a party the other night, the 4th of July, and she said that some of these episodes were so moving that she would be moved to tears, and she had to stop listening to the podcast at work because she didn't think that when she told her coworkers she was listening to music that they were buying it, and she had to keep her shit together at her job. And I took that as a very high compliment. Some of these things are emotionally compelling. But I'm sad that I can't help her distract herself from her job anymore. But it was for good reason. Can I plug for a second? Because I got these shows coming up in Boulder, Colorado, Friday, July 24th at the Boulder Theater, and at the Paramount Theater in Denver, Colorado, on Saturday, July 25th. And I like some people to go. I mean, we're doing okay. But it'd be nice if more people came. I don't always know if people know I'm coming. It doesn't seem that there's anything I can do to get the word out as efficiently as I might want to. So I'm telling you now, Boulder, Friday, July 24th, and Denver, Saturday, July 25th. That's that. That's how that goes. Laura Jane Grace is on the show today. She is the singer for the band Against Me, punk rock band that's been around for a lot of years. I knew nothing about them. I knew nothing about her when I got the record in the mail. I don't even know who sent me the record. But I put it on, as I do many of the records I get, most of the records I get. And I listen to it, and I'm like, damn, this singer means business. This band means business. There's a lot going on here. There's something underneath all this. And the band, the album was called Transgender Dysphoria Blues. Still had no idea, knew nothing about them. And it turns out Laura Jane Grace is transgender, and it's relatively new that she is Laura Jane Grace. And I became sort of fascinated with that, because whatever that struggle was, in my mind, when I just did a little bit of research, really informed this record. That this record was about, you know, real change, real conflict, struggle, and identity. And I was nervous. I don't know if I was nervous, but I'm awkward in... I'm sort of an old guy when it comes to this, the politics around it and the social momentum, and I didn't know if I was going to talk right. I mean, I'm not saying it's new. It's not in my everyday life necessarily. It seems like the younger people who kind of came up with it and grew up with it, like the woman I'm dating, Sarah, who spent a lot of time in San Francisco, and she's in her mid 30s, and It was just, it just is what it is. But I seem to have missed that, or perhaps I was just in stand-up comedy clubs my entire young adulthood and not out in the world. But I was nervous in a way, because I've said, look, you can say whatever you want. This is a weird thing about words, names, you know, things that are, that we evolve out of culturally. But this sort of reflects back to my conversation with the president and to, you know, some of the type of feedback that comes around words, is that, you know, censorship is really cultural. There's no law saying you can't say anything. You can say anything you want. Free speech does exist. You can say whatever you want. Just know that if you say something that is hurtful or insensitive or objectifying, hateful, you're going to feel that. You're going to have to answer to it, perhaps. But it's not taken lightly. And then I understand, like, you know, there is an argument that, like, you know, people shouldn't be so sensitive, or what's happening. People should be able to take the hit or whatnot. But the truth of the matter is, no one's telling you can't say anything. You just might end up only hanging out with people that say that, because they're the only people you can say it to. And then you're just going to have to assess, is that the group of people you want to be hanging out with? And are we in the right place with things? I mean, I'm a comedian, so you can say words that are culturally inappropriate, hateful, objectifying. You can say them to people that they may be in a broader sense directed at, but those people have a sense of humor about it, and that is part of your unique relationship with that person. That's fine. But you know, if you say them, if you defend your right to say them to a large group of people, You better have a pretty good defense on some level. But I had a thing with the word tranny. I believe I talked to RuPaul about this, who then defended the word and got his own flack from it. You know, in my mind, it just seems to me that words come and go. That words, it's something about a social democracy, a cultural democracy, that eventually, you know, public opinion, you know, moves past it out of respect for the usually minority that was being dehumanized by the language. You don't say Chinaman anymore. You know, you don't say WAP. Tranny, you know, seem like an innocuous one to even me, but as culture evolves and communities grow and demand the respect they deserve as people, maybe the slang bothers them. Maybe it hurts their feelings. Maybe it makes them feel less than. But no one's saying you can't say anything. It's just the way cultural democracy works and social democracy works. Is eventually it's sort of like, hey, well, you know what? This word is hurtful and it's dehumanizing and it's making a community of people feel shitty about themselves. And it's not easy for them to begin with, but they can say it. that's just part of the way it goes, but to demand equal rights on that, well, then you're gonna have to sort of really explain where that's coming from, your need to say that, whatever that may be. But getting back to Laura Jane Grace coming over, I just needed to know. There was a lot of things I needed to know. And there was a lot of things I needed to know about her. There was a lot of things I needed to know about, you know, my engagement and interaction with transgender people. And, you know, I want to grow. I want to be up to speed. I want to be appropriate. It's hard. It's a hard shift to make around, you know, just changing habits, especially word-wise. I mean, it was hard. It's hard to let go of certain words, you know, especially when they got a little punch to them. I mean, you know, it took a lot for me to let go of retard. Any of the flack I got for that was from families of mentally challenged people. It's hard for me not to use the word cunt, but I never use it for women. I only use it for men, and I'm still not quite past that. Sometimes I enjoy, calling a guy a cunt on Twitter. Sometimes I enjoy it. And it's hard. It's hard to let go of that. Tranny was not a big one that I used a lot. So that one wasn't hard to shift out, to rotate out. But, we all make mistakes. I said gypped the other day. And someone said, that's slang, is derogatory, against gypsies. And then my first response was like, really, really? Is there anybody really upset about that, gypped? It's like Jewed down. Yeah, but is that really? Okay. Yeah, all right. Okay. I'll be aware. I'll be aware, and I will, and I can take that out of rotation. Because once you start doing that, and once you start being aware of those words, it sort of opens you up to experience things in a new way. It opens up, a different type of respect. It takes down a wall that's sort of defensive or based on lack of sensitivity, and it opens you up a little bit. And I was very open here. I liked Laura Jane Grace's work, but I was nervous because I didn't want to be inappropriate in terms of how I handled the conversation around what I needed to talk about, which is what happened inside of you to make these decisions. I want to know. I want to feel what you feel. I think I did all right. I think so. Been going through stuff, doing some summer cleaning. And folks, I do try to listen. This is the interesting thing about the, sometimes things get through. I get a lot of artwork, which I always keep, and I'm running out of space to put it up. I appreciate all of your creativity, and I'm very flattered by it. Even though the president saw it as narcissistic, a lot of the pictures of me are pictures that you guys do here in the garage. All the CDs that come from you personally and the vinyl that comes from you personally, I try to listen to. More so the records, because I'm into records. CDs, I'll go through, but I make snap judgments. But I'm just telling you this. Sometimes things get through. I will listen to all the vinyl at least once for a bit, and a lot of the CDs, and sometimes things get through. Like Against Me's Transgender Dysphoria Blues, it got through. And they are on tour right now. Against Me is on tour. You can go to againstme.net for tour dates. You can get Transgender Dysphoria Blues, and you can pre-order their new live album, which comes out in September. And they've got a very prolific band. There's a big catalog there. So now I'm going to talk to Laura Jane Grace.
I actually put all my stuff in storage right before I left on this most recent jaunt, just because I was like, my landlord wanted to raise the rent, and I was just like, screw it, this is ridiculous.
Oh my God.
Paying like whatever.
That's
for
crazy touring.
Yeah, well, that's what you got to do to make a living as a musician,
But I mean, like, do you have a house?
Well, I own a house with my ex, who I'm going through a divorce with. I own a house in Florida that I rented out.
What part of Florida?
St. Augustine.
Oh, really?
But beyond like having a house there, I'd been in Chicago since like 2013 or whatever.
In an apartment?
In an apartment, yeah.
In Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
Since 2013?
Yes, August of 2013.
That's when you split up with the wife?
That is, yeah. Uh-huh. Or that's when it all went to shit.
That's fuck. When everything got fucked?
Yeah. Life has a tendency to do that to you sometimes.
Well, you've gone through some dramatic shifts in the last few years.
That's understated, huh?
Yeah. But like, here's the thing is what I was telling you is I know we have a lot of common fans and people were excited to have us talk, is that I don't know where I got the new record, the Transgender Dysphoria Blues, but it was sent to me by your label or somebody.
Well, and we're our own label, so I don't know.
I don't know how I got it.
Yeah. But that's cool. You have it.
You didn't send it to me?
No. I mean, unless maybe our management did or publicist, I don't know, or something like that.
Yeah. All I know is that like I get a lot of records, I get a lot of records mm-hmm. sent to me, and I listen to them. And I put this one on, and I'm like, well, this sounds fucking real. And I'll listen to records that people send me, and they don't always click, right. For whatever reason.
I do too, yeah.
Right? And mm-hmm. you just put it on, you're like, I'm not going to listen to this again.
Yeah.
But this one, I'm like, my God, I wasn't do it again. And I was like, there's some earnest, angry, interesting shit on here.
Cool.
And then I kind of did a little research into you, and I'm like, who the hell's this person? Well, and then like when I think I actually tweeted that I liked the record, mm-hmm. and then everybody was like, oh, you got to have Laura on. And then I realized that you have this following, and you've been around for a while. So yeah. Then I had to go back, as I do, and I got to buy the other records. See, you sold a few records in the last few days. But the interesting thing about it is, like, and I also had to look up dysphoria.
Most people trip up and say dysmorphia or some other variation of that.
Yeah. Right. Well, I didn't know what exactly it was, but it's like a fairly familiar state to any creative person. It's a uneasiness and a depressive uneasiness, right?
Kind of the opposite of euphoria.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but it seems to me that, you know, despite the title of this record and whatever you've gone through recently, that like for someone who was gravitated to punk rock, dysphoria was something you live with all your life.
It was, yeah, for sure. I mean, it was what pushed me to punk rock, just because punk rock seemed like such a, it was like armor, you know,
yeah.
Like studs and spikes on your leather jacket and a mohawk, and
right,
like, yeah.
So where'd you grow up?
South Florida, Naples, Florida.
See, I don't know anything about it. I know Florida, like sometimes I get a little weird about Florida, but my mother lives down there.
A lot of people there. Do. Well, a lot of people's mothers live in Florida.
Right. But like there's an element down there that in my mind, like, and people have gotten mad at me for busting on Florida, but some people, there's like, it's sort of the end of the line down there. In a lot of ways, mentally and physically for some people.
For sure. And well, that was very much the perspective growing up of like, you are at the end of the line and the only way to look was north, because
right.
unless you wanted to swim, you
right.
know, like you
yeah.
had to go north, especially
you
Naples. Yeah. And that was like, you know, pre-internet days. So it's like no bands ever toured down there. There was no pre-existing punk scene.
Yeah.
You know, that was when you really had to kind of invent your own thing when you were a kid.
How old are you?
I'm 34.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And what was your family like? I mean, what were they doing down there? Why'd you end up there?
I grew up in a military family, and my parents divorced when I was like 12, 13 years old. So I moved with my mother and my younger brother in with my grandmother, who had retired to Naples, Florida.
So that was it?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that doesn't sound great.
No, I mean, it was not a good experience. Well, we moved from Naples, Italy to Naples, Florida.
Oh.
And I had lived in Italy then at that point for like 4 or 5 years, you know,
yeah.
and really had gotten accustomed to that, because it was probably like from grades like second grade until like fifth, sixth grade, you know?
Uh-huh. And there's an American base there?
There is.
Uh-huh. And what was your dad in the military?
He was a West Point graduate, so he was a major in the U.S. Army.
Wow. Is he still around?
He retired. He did 20 years, and then he retired outside of Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri.
Really? And do you guys talk?
He hasn't talked to me since I came out. Or really? We haven't talked since I came out, yeah.
Since you came out. Is there two processes of coming out?
I guess there is when you're somebody who like does interviews and, you know, has a public persona. There's the private and the public, sure.
Right. But I, when you say coming out as a transgender person.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that was that becomes relatively obvious. So eventually, right.
Well, that was kind of the point, was to go ahead and come out before anything was relatively obvious.
Right.
Because I thought that would, like, especially having, you know, I play in a band, I have a career, and like people in the punk scene are in general kind of homophobic and kind
right.
of sexist. So if I would have not come out and just started like wearing eyeliner or expressing femininity, I think people would have been like, you know, way more unaccepting than if I had just said, look, this is what's going on to me. Can you please fuck off while I go through this? And just like, you know, maybe it'll be weird sometimes. I might not look totally great all the time, you know,
right,
like,
right.
but this is what it is. So
right.
you know ahead of time.
So, but it's sort of funny though, like in my mind that like real punk rock purists, if you just started showing up with eyeliner and stuff, they might, as you know, they might even think that you were moving towards some other type of music.
Oh, totally. Well, like Green Day is a great example
yeah.
of that. I mean, that was the first punk show I ever went to.
And yeah.
people make fun of Billy Joe sometimes for wearing eyeliner.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is totally homophobic, you know,
yeah.
and totally transphobic and fucked up. You know?
But it's also like, I think it also represents another kind of music. I mean, you see, you know, makeup more in goth and in rock and roll. And I think maybe punk is sort of supposed to be just, you know, raw.
Right, I guess. I mean, it depends on what kind of perception of punk rock you had. And like, because like, if you look back at like lineage of punk bands, like Susie Sue and the Banshees, they were a punk band, you know, like they, like, I mean, even The Cure had elements in punk rock starting out, you know, and like there used to just be a wider variety of what was able to interpret. Mike Ness, Social Fucking Distortion, Another State of Mind is like, you know, covered in eyeliner, the whole thing.
Because I talked to him, Mike Watt recently. And there's like, because there's a punk rock style, but the original punk rock was really just about doing whatever the fuck you wanted.
Totally. And that's what attracted me to it, because that seemed like it would be more of a safe space, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the, like, especially like late 70s English peace punk bands that were really into anarchist politics and stuff like that, I was really drawn to that just because that was even way more liberal and like way more about like, you know, gender liberation and smashing, you know, smashing the state.
But they happened like earlier. I mean, you're coming to that. They were already nostalgia acts by then, right? By the time you were coming to it, like they've been around a while.
Yeah, although it's funny to think about that stuff, because I think about that in like relative to my own career and how like, okay, you know, almost been a band for 20 years and how like...
Has it been 20?
Almost, yeah. And like that it doesn't seem like as wide of a gap, even though it is as long to compared to when I was listening to those bands from the late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
It's like only 10 years difference.
I guess that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, okay, so your dad and mom split. You're 13. He's in the military. He hasn't talked to you now, what, in like 3 or 4 years?
Yeah.
But you were talking before that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's tough. Like, when my parents split up, you know, like, there was a definite separation. And, you know, that, like, it was a dividing thing in my family. And kind of in ways, a relationship never really recovered, you know?
Were you close when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the military is really a thing, you know? And if you're someone who's... you know, went to West Point and has been in the Army for a long time, like, you know, generally being really emotionally expressive or close, you know, and like open like that is not a thing, you know, like it's just kind of a cold, especially when it's a German background too, you know.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
He comes from a German background?
Mm-hmm.
But what about your mom?
What kind of background?
Well, no, but I mean, like, how was your relationship with her? Was she the buffer?
Yeah, and I mean, I was really close with my mom. I was first kid or whatever. I had a younger brother, but...
There's like, two of you?
Mm-hmm.
Where's he at?
He's in South Florida.
Really?
Uh-huh. He's like, see, if I wouldn't have started smoking when I was 13 years old, I would have probably been his height. He's like 6'7".
You're pretty tall.
Yeah, 6'2". But again, that would have been another 5 inches if I wouldn't have started smoking. But he cracks safes for a living, and he owns his own business installing like high-end security system for people and security systems in South Florida.
So you guys get along?
Yeah, we do.
All right, so there you are. You're like, you get there when you're like 12 or 13 to Naples, and what's it like down there? I can't picture it. Is it just a wasteland, or what is it? Pretty
well. It, you know, starting then was a real period of economic growth where, like, you know, during that period of time, I think there are more millionaires per capita in Collier County, Florida, than anywhere else in the U.S. And the two cities in Collier County are Naples and Immokalee. Immokalee being a migrant farm worker community with like extreme levels of poverty, you know. So there was a real contrast. And in general, like, it was a retirement community. So it's an older Republican white retirement community that doesn't want youth to be... to be seen or heard, really.
Right.
There just wasn't a lot to do besides like get in trouble, you know?
Right. And what was the kind of trouble you were getting into?
You know, it, like small shit, like vandalism, like you go to a golf course and you kick all the sprinkler heads off and stuff like that. And then, you know.
We used to rip hood ornaments off of cars.
Yeah, or stealing chromies off of tires stuff like that, you know, or like taking a battery and throwing at car windows. Dumb shit.
Pellet guns. We had pellet gun.
Guns, all that stuff, you know.
And what was the music that, how did you form your little crew? I mean, because I don't know what year are we talking about?
So that 1993 was, or so, something like that.
So were you the oddballs, you and your friends were you were the punk rock kids?
Totally. And we went like, I mean, my group of friends that I kind of went into high school with, like we met in middle school. And like at first it was like, you know, listening to classic rock bands, Led Zeppelin, The Doors, Pink Floyd.
It's always there.
And, and then like, but that like, there was a real disconnect with the like kind of hippie movement that we associated with that, because we got beat up a lot. And it seemed like by jocks, you know, like we were the freaks, you know, like, and you sit together at lunch.
But not the hippie freaks.
Well, it was all just like you were the freaks. Freak. They're like, small population. So it was like the skaters, the hippies, the goth kids, everybody sat together. But punk rock appealed because it seemed a little bit more about fighting back. And like, even if you're going to get your ass kicked, throwing up a couple punches in.
Yeah.
So that, Like,
and did you?
Yeah, totally, totally. I mean, you know, to varying results, but it felt better to fight back, you know?
Yeah. And what bands were you listening to?
The first record was Nevermind the Bollocks, Sex Pistols. And then that led into The Clash. And like, there was all those classic punk bands that you first listened to, like the Dead Kennedys and the Misfits. Yeah. And then we kind of like gravitated towards what was more going on in the U.S. of like bands out on the West Coast, like Bad Religion and Rancid and NOFX.
Yeah.
And then like, just like, you know, you back then you'd read the liner notes and see who they thanked. And then you'd go buy those records.
Right.
And if you liked them, you'd see who they thanked.
And they were records.
Right, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Weren't they still records then?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't CDs yet?
I did CDs and vinyl, but I've always preferred vinyl.
So when did you start playing guitar?
When I was 8 years old.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So who taught you that? I mean, who gave you the guitar?
I saved up money mowing lawns, and I like got $5 a pop, and
where?
That's all I had.
Where were you when you were mowing lawns? Not in Italy.
Yeah, in Italy.
Really?
I ordered it out of a Sears.
You were the American lawn mowing kid.
Yeah.
When you ordered it out of a Sears catalog, what were you, time traveling?
I did. It was $125.
You got a Sears guitar?
It was a Harmony guitar.
Oh, Harmony. Yeah. Is that a Sears? That's a Sears brand.
It was out of the Sears catalog.
Yeah. Oh shit! It was an electric?
No, it was an acoustic.
That's like time traveling to me, like a Sears catalog. I didn't even know they still, that was your idea? Well, I guess you're eight, what do you
like,
know?
Where did you get it? When you're an American family that moves overseas, you're really cut off, and especially back then, you were still really dependent on people back home and ordering things from back home.
Oh, so someone got it for you?
No, like I say, that we, oh, you'd get the catalog, I saved my money. And
then, you sent away for it?
Yeah, uh-huh. And I had to wait like a month, like, and then they sent the guitar.
And how'd you learn?
I took lessons from an army wife at first.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
And she just taught on bass and...
Yeah. No, she taught at her home. Like, we lived off bass or whatever. And so...
And you went over there and you learned your basics?
Yeah, just like once a week.
G, A, C, D, E, then the bar chords.
It's messed up though, because like learning on an acoustic like that, especially when you're a kid, when you don't have strong fingers, like those guitars are basically like made for archery. Like
the steel string, right? The steel string?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And the strings are like an inch off the fretboard. It's hard to press down. Yeah. So that was really discouraging at first.
What were your first songs?
I wasn't really interested at first, like because it was all like, you know, whatever.
You saved up for the guitar.
I know, but the book they gave you, it was just like, you know, it was like
Michael wrote his brother's show.
Yeah, like I didn't want to play that. So like I stuck with it, but I never felt like I was like, oh, I'm bad. I can't really play this because I was totally uninterested. But I stuck with it. And then like finally when I was like maybe 11 years old, I started like playing in bands, like just with my church group. We started up bands. And
what kind of church were you in?
It was a Presbyterian church that my mother brought us to.
I have no idea.
Just more like when she divorced, she wanted to be social and there was like childcare.
Sure. You know, it wasn't, you didn't grow up with the weight of God on you?
Not heavy, no.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So now when do you start to feel different?
I felt different my whole life. Those are like earliest memories, you know?
Uh-huh. Like earliest memories? Like what are we talking
about? If I can like think of my three earliest memories, which are like kind of just, you know, those weird disconnected visual impressions. I remember maybe being 3 years old and like standing on the top of a staircase as the first one. And then I remember probably 4 or 5 years old, Fort Hood, Texas, standing in the living room in front of the TV and Madonna was on the TV and feeling a sense of identity in watching Madonna perform.
Right.
And it was like a weird moment of both like, oh, that's amazing. You know, she's performing, she's dancing, she's singing, you know, like this is crazy music I've never heard before. And I like the melody.
Sure.
But then also a feeling of like, I could do that too. And immediately recognizing, but like, wait, I'm not, that's not how people perceive me. There's a disconnect.
Really? And how old were you?
4 or 5.
Huh. And then what, how else did that
then happen? After that, I distinctly remember like within a year or two after watching Rosemary's Baby and like feeling oddly drawn to Mia Farrow because she had like the pixie haircut.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, wait, maybe there's a chance for me because I have hair like that. That's how my parents get my hair cut. So maybe I'm not wrong. Maybe I could grow up to be like that.
Yeah. You could grow up to be a woman.
Grow up to be Mia Farrow in particular.
All right.
I had lofty ambitions. Yeah. Madonna or Mia Farrow. I fell a little short, but
good role models.
It's not over yet.
Yeah. Like, all right, so you're playing guitar, you're 11, and you're starting to decide what music you like? 11 or 12?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I got a Walkman when I was 8 years old, around when I first got a guitar, and I started buying metal tapes. Like, I got Def Leppard Hysteria was the first metal record.
So that was your music?
Bought. Yeah. And that was like, I was drawn to them because I saw in them ambiguity in their sex.
But you also like the music.
I did, although some of it really, you know.
Well, yeah.
But I liked looking at them,
but I mean,
really.
You could find plenty of ambiguity in rock music.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, yeah. But you felt that.
Right. But at the same time, too, because I lived overseas, I was totally cut off from MTV. Like, I really was stumbling into stuff on my own. So, like, I found Hit Parader magazine. I looked at the pictures, and I was like, I can't tell if these are boys or girls.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then I'd go and buy the tapes, and some stuff I'd like and some stuff I wouldn't.
But you found that a lot of what compelled you was the androgyny of the people.
Yeah, but then like the bands I was really drawn to was like the had more of the nihilistic attitude. Like Guns N' Roses in particular was like my band when I was a kid. So
they're a good band.
They had Appetite is great, and I stand behind
great.
Illusions too should have been Illusions should have been one record, but other than that,
right? Lies was good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got no problem with. I don't know what happened with Chinese Democracy, but that's,
I bought it, so I can criticize it.
I know I bought it.
Yeah,
I didn't like it.
No.
I don't know that I listened to it twice.
I listened to it a bunch of times, but
Illusions, you know. I listened to twice. Mm-hmm. So what was it? So you reinventing Axl Rose was your first record.
Right.
Now, all right, but I don't want to miss a time chunk here. So you lock into Guns N' Roses at like 11 or what?
10? 8 years old.
8 years old.
Uh-huh.
That's when Appetite, when it first came out?
88. It came out 87. I was 8 years old.
And he's a great fucking singer.
Uh-huh.
Compelling.
Totally. Yeah. All of them are Duff and Slash.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like I wore a Sid chain because Duff wore one before I knew who Sid Vicious was.
Right. So you were pretty primed by the time you got to the Pistols mm-hmm. with rock.
Yeah, I knew a little bit, yeah.
A little bit? Now, you know everything if you listen to Guns N' Roses and you lock in at 8. What it's all there. But when do you start realizing that this is your future, and when do you start feeling... Like I'm making an assumption in that as your creativity evolved and became what it was in these first few records, that your frustration with yourself must have been happening alongside of that.
Right. Well, I mean, I made the decision was what I was going to do really young.
Music-wise?
Like I dropped out of high school when I was 16. I never had any doubts. I just knew this was what I was going to do one way or the other. Yeah. Even if I was unsuccessful at it, this is what I was going to do.
But you never started playing metal, though. You never started playing
metal. No. Like, the first bands I ever had, like, that by that time, it was more grunge bands. Like, we'd cover Nirvana songs and Pearl Jam songs.
Oh, yeah?
And then, like, at the same time doing, like, Pink Floyd songs or Beatles songs. And then that was, like, and then we got into punk rock.
And that's how you learn how to play, I guess, basically, with other people, is play the hits,
it's
the classic.
Stupid how I can still remember to play songs from then. Like, I know how to play Even Flow, but I don't remember how to play some of the songs I wrote like 5 years ago.
Really?
So.
Well, it sticks with you, right?
It does, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why it's a hit song.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
So, because when I listen to like some of the older stuff, like, it's sort of fascinating to me that there, you know, that the punk rock form, like, it feels a little familiar, like you, like in the sense that like the Clash, or like I can tell where you're coming from,
mm-hmm.
but your singing is so, you know, kind of raw and brutal and full of a type of intensity and anger that is, you know, rare, and you know, you don't sound like anybody else. But like in looking at the arc of your life, I have to assume that the anger that you were feeling became much more defined with this new record.
For sure. It was like, it was there. I mean, you mentioned that a second ago. Like, really what, like, made the anger levels, like, grow and dysphoria grow as, like, my band progressed was as we experienced success.
Uh-huh.
And as you're further cast into... Because when we started out with really, like, specific ideals of being against all that, you know? And
against,
like,
me, it comes from what?
Being 17 years old and feeling like everything in the world's conspiring against you.
And then you're pushing back with this music.
Sure, that was my outlet. And, you know, we were really starting out of the way the band started as far as on an acoustic guitar. It was because, like, I didn't have an electric guitar, so I played an acoustic guitar. The drummer didn't have a drum set, so we dumpstered of pickle buckets, made a drum set, and that's what we did. And we didn't have places to play because it was South Florida, so we busked on the street. And then eventually, like, you met other people.
At least you were set up for that.
Yeah, well, that was the idea, you know, like, and that was what it was modeled on.
That's how Billy Bragg sort of started, I think, and the Violent Femmes kind of, and they're
totally
bands.
And I was heavily, heavily influenced by both of them. And
oh, really?
Like, yeah, that was part of the beginning.
yeah. So you're busking, and you're doing this, you're doing your original songs.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they're sort of, so those were two, a couple of your influences, but there's some Clash in there.
Sure, the Clash. And again, like all the peace punk bands, Crass, like Crass, The Mob, yeah. Like Flux of Pink Indians.
But that comes
Boys
a little later.
Girls.
You can't really do that with an acoustic and buckets.
Right. Well, when I was 14 years old, I got arrested. And it was like life-changing experience for me. Because I was like 14 years old, beat up by the cops, charged with resisting arrest and a battery on an officer, tried as an adult, convicted as a felon by the time I was 15 years old.
For
as
what?
I went to the beach 4th of July. I like ran into the wrong cops. I was a dirty, smelly punk kid. And I got lippy with them when they got up in my face. And then they beat me up.
And were you playing in a band at that point or no?
Yes, I was playing in a band. Not against me, but I was playing in a punk band at that point.
Uh-huh.
I had like
so
black,
this was,
spiky
this
hair.
This
was
almost
like
a rites of passage.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I didn't see it coming, but yeah. So
but I mean, so what happened? Why was it a life-changing experience?
I mean, because I was fucked, you know? Like I was 15 years old and I was a twice convicted felon. Like I had really already sealed my deal as far as what my options were for the future. Like I was tried as an adult.
You didn't do jail time, did you?
No, I got like 180 hours of community service and I was on house arrest for a whole summer, you know? I was like low-jacked, so.
Where the fuck did you do that much community service?
I worked in a hospital and I volunteered in the cardio wing, like giving people like jello cups and water after they'd been walking
the
on
the punk
a treadmill.
Kid with the jello cups.
And I did Habitat for Humanity, and then I did like
you could choose what you could do.
Well, I just had a lot of hours, so I had to do a bunch of stuff. And then there was this place, the conservancy, that was like a nature conservancy. So
well, that must have been, some of those sound pretty good, like they could have been good experiences.
I got great things out of them, but it was like when you're 15 years old and you're in that situation, right. You're scared shitless.
Sure.
And my
okay.
mom didn't have any money and right. Like they're threatening you, like you're gonna go to jail or you're gonna go to juvie,
yeah.
You know, and I didn't want to do that, you
yeah.
know. I wanted to hang out with my friends and play music,
right?
And so like I immediately had that weight on me, you know, and it was at that point, because up until then, like I had already gotten into drugs and alcohol and stuff like that.
What was your shit?
I really liked tripping on acid, and I really liked coke, and I really liked smoking weed.
Yeah.
And at that point when I got arrested, I just like sobered up, and uh-huh. I was like 16 years old,
yeah.
Trying to get focused, get on track.
Right.
And that was when I started playing music, and that's when I, or like more seriously, and stumbled into Against Me.
So you stopped doing the drugs
mm-hmm.
and just full on focus. So that's where all that insane, you know, vocal energy comes from. You just the clarity of pure anger.
I was pissed.
Fear. Yeah.
I was pissed. Yeah.
Uh-huh. But then, like, it sort of, it seems to me like, you know, and I'm, you know, maybe being presumptuous or maybe not fully, you know, recognizing the arc of it. It just seems like, you know, the first couple records are full on. And then at some point around the third record, you did become a little self-aware and that you were shifting your perception of what you were really doing creatively.
Sure. Yeah. And a lot of that just had to come. It came with success because like we came from the scene that was really about this certain thing, DIY punk ethics.
Who is and you guys, you honored that by, like there was no punk scene. Like you did what a lot of the bands, a lot of the guys I've talked to.
We started it ourselves. Yeah. Put
right.
out our own first
record.
But
records. This is two
yeah.
decades. I mean, this is a decade later from the original wave of those guys. Right. Or at least.
This is like, well.
Like you did have the internet.
Yeah, totally. But it was coming as it was all happening and file sharing was happening and that
right.
was all changing. But it was, you know, like I was dealing with a much different perspective than people must have assumed I was dealing with. And part of that for me was always being recognizing like that I was dealing with dysphoria, you know, or like that I had that. And so it like always skewed my perspective.
But that's
like,
retrospect. This is retrospect that you're saying that with. Like, I mean, you...
Sure,
you,
sure. No, but it detached me. You know, like I saw things like, okay, like this is my circumstance, right?
Yeah.
This is what I'm facing. I'm playing in this band. These people are now calling me a sellout because we moved to a slightly bigger indie label. They're giving us all this money. All of a sudden, we got a lawyer, we got a manager, we got a booking
agent.
And
your original fans are fuck-ewing you?
Yeah, and they're like slashing our tires, being
really?
Physically abusive, attacking us
at
shows.
Hold on. So when you start out, when you put yourself did your first record, right?
First like two, like a 7-inch and a 12-inch we put out, just like, you know.
So that's like, that's righteous to that crew, the DIY punk rock crew. And they can buy them at your shows. And they can buy your t-shirts and
right.
you're
like
playing
$5 for a 12
and you're shit. Playing on bills. Did you spend any time opening for acts that you respected, that
we just
kind of
booked
shit?
Our own tours and went out and did our own tours,
so like, there was never
playing
any
in house
that.
Shows playing in basements, playing on the streets, still like playing. Sometimes you get a club gig, but it was all booking it yourself for the first like 4 or 5 years.
But there was never the sort of like a bigger punk band came into town, they needed a punk opener, and you
well
did
in Gainesville where we moved to, No Idea Records exists, and No Idea does a really good job job of documenting the punk scene there. And they've had a couple bands like Hot Water Music and Less Than Jake that have gone on to do things.
Yeah.
You know, they took a notice of us. We put out a record with them. And that was like the first step to a really small indie. And already then people decried like sellouts. But then, well, then we moved to like Fat Records, which is like slightly bigger, you know, indie. A band that, you know, run by Fat Mike, who we had grown up listening to NoFX. And then that was like even more intense wave of like your sellouts, you know, like total witch
hunt. Why? Because NoFX was sellout at that point?
Because it was a bigger indie. And then we started working with
Fuck are these people?
They're punks.
No, I get it. But like at a certain point, do you realize like we might have to lose? They'll come back around.
Well, no, I mean, it was more just realize the hypocrisy of it. But once I saw that hypocrisy of it, then I like was like, oh, fuck this. That, you know, like do the punk thing. Think for yourself. These are my circumstances. This is what I have to do. These are the decisions that are right for me. There's nothing wrong with doing the things I want to do.
Right.
And so I wanted to be in a band and play for larger audiences. And as you do that more and more, because we were touring like, you know, fucking 9 months out of the year, playing like 200 some odd shows a year, like driving ourselves into the ground. And most of the time we were homeless, you know, like, so eventually you're like, oh, it'd be nice to have an apartment.
You know, like, you don't be grown up. A shower. Yeah, like, my own shower.
That'd be great, you know?
But like, you know, when around the third record, that's the new label?
Well, that's when, like, yeah, and we started getting major label attention. And we got courted one whole round and, like, turned it down, got a bigger deal from, like, our indie, and then went and, like, finally ended up signing with Warner Sire.
So what was that record?
That we
White did, Cross, or which record was the first record on the new label?
The first record on the major label was New Wave.
Okay. So, because, like, I listened to a few of the songs, and it seems that, like, as you're saying, you know, that these punks sort of abandoned you, or they slashed your tires, or they were mad that you were sellouts, that you also realized the limitations of that outlook.
Sure. Totally.
Uh-huh. Like you were maturing along with your success.
Right.
In a way. It wasn't killing you.
No, and it was healthy. That was like the one good thing I had going for me, you know?
So this dysphoria, because like, you know, I imagine I had dysphoria for one reason or another. So like you're malcontent, at that juncture where, you know, you blow yourself out on all the punk rock shit, and obviously you get a little older, a little more successful, and you're still feeling a little shitty, then it starts to become about something else, not just about, you know, class warfare or
dysphoria comes back. Yeah, because that was the thing, is like, you know, you jump into this where you're like, oh shit, our band's getting like traction, we're gonna go off and we're gonna tour for 3-4 years or something, and then you're still unhappy. And at first you were able to push the dysphoria aside because you're able to solely focus on that, you know, like, I'm going to be this person, I'm going to do this
thing. How are you operating within the band? I mean, where was your sexuality at?
I mean, it was there, you know. Well, I got married when I was 19 years old, and I was married from when I was 19, and we probably became estranged from each other when I was like 21.
Yeah.
So then like 22 to 23, I was going through the whole like, oh shit, my marriage just fell apart, like really throwing myself.
This is the first marriage or the one that just ended?
My first marriage.
So you've been married twice?
Yes.
Okay.
And so then like
19.
Yeah. And so 22 and 23, 24 were like the lost years of coming out of a marriage and being really fucked up.
It's worse.
And sleeping around a lot, and
yeah,
you're in a band that's touring a bunch and just doing stupid shit.
Right. So where'd you meet that woman?
At a bar. Where did I meet her? No, yeah. I met her at an activist info shop at the Civic Media Center, I think.
An activist info
shop.
Oh.
A non-corporate press lending library and activist space in Gainesville, Florida, called the Civic Media Center is where we met.
What was that place? What did they have there?
I volunteered there. It was like an activist organizing center. Okay. Everything from like a women's group to like, you know, radical bike workshops to activist training.
A full service activist training center?
Totally. Totally. Exactly.
What are you fighting against?
It's a recruit.
These are the basic
capitalism.
Rules.
Yeah. Capitalism is that was the.
Oh, that's a big enemy. One. That's a big one. We're gonna have to get a few books out. There's a few booklets on capitalism.
Noam Chomsky's luckily written a bunch. So.
Yeah. Good luck with that. Getting through the Noam Chomsky's. Did you read all of his?
I did. I read all the Emmett Goldman, all the Peter Kropotkin, all that stuff.
So you just got a head full of it.
I used to volunteer there and I booked shows there. They'd let me book punk shows. And that was where Against Me just like played all the time because that was the only place they would let us play.
So your singular political agenda was against capitalism? In your mind?
I mean, at the time, it was really against, like, you know, the World Trade Organization at the time of, like, the 1999, like, riots in Seattle. Right. All that protest movement was really happening. And that was, like, all my friends were a part of that. I had, like, connected with an activist group in Florida doing Food Not Bombs.
Yeah.
And we organized into something called FRAN, which was the Florida Radical Activist Network.
Uh-huh.
And we'd meet up, like, once a month, all talk about what we had going on in our area.
Right.
And then organize, like, rides to bigger protests or demonstrations against, like...
So you've been an activist all your life. Really?
In one form or another, yeah.
Huh. So that's pretty earnest, man. That's some earnest punk shit. Because, like, I'm sort of fascinated with the whole sort of, like, now, like, as I said at the beginning, this record, you know, when I read the lyrics and I listen to it, the activism, you know, it's very personal.
Mm-hmm.
That because of your transformation, that, you know, you've resolved some things in yourself. And you realize there's still a lack of understanding and there's still a lot of reasons to be angry about, you know, how you're interpreted.
Sure.
It's very personal. So you're bringing that same intensity that you saw global injustice, you know, to this, you know, very sort of, your heart's connected to this in a way that is non-negotiable.
I'd like to think that it's a little smarter even than, like, the politics I was singing about when I was younger. I mean, of course. If you're familiar with, like, Embrace, Ian MacKaye's band, your emotions are nothing but politics. And this is something that's really real to me. The things I was singing about when I was younger, while I felt the way I felt and still agree with it, I didn't have as big of an understanding or a worldview at 19 years old as I do now at 34, having, like, been around the world a number of times, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to do political talk radio, lefty talk radio. And at some point I realized that, like, I don't know if I'm angry about these specific things. I know that I'm angry.
Mm-hmm.
So let's address the existential and personal foundation or the core of that anger.
Exactly.
And do it. So you were married once and that fizzled out and then you went through heartbreak. When do you start wrestling with the desire to become a woman?
Well, like 2005 or so, you know, I'd gotten really fucked up on cocaine. And then 2005, I was like, I'm going to be sober. I got sober.
So you went back to drugs.
Yeah. Cleaned myself up. And, like, at the same time, after having gone through a bout of, like, the way it worked back then was, like, these experience of extreme dysphoria and then, like, binging and purging and being like, no, you know, like, I'm going to be a man. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to pretend I do not feel this way. And that coincided with, like, signing a major record label deal. And then you're swept off on that roller coaster. But then come down from that, you know, when, like, you do two records and they're not a success or anything like that. We went through this fucking lawsuit with the next manager. Things like, you know, like, friends die, shit happens in life. And you realize, like, I still feel this way. You know, I'm fucked up.
You're uncomfortable.
And I'm living this two separate lives. I'm married. I now have a kid. We bought a house, you know, like, and I don't know who I am, you know?
Right. So when you did that, when you got married that second time, you know, was it, you know, were you reacting to your feelings? Did you think that by doing that, you know, you could sort of train yourself into that life?
I think about it often just because I wonder if it's, like, subconscious, you know, because I would hate to think that. But I was really, like, you know, I got focused, I got sober, I got healthy. I was like, you know, I wasn't fucked up making bad decisions. And then I fell in love. And I didn't want to fall in love, but I fell in love. And it was more that, like, I fell in love and I ignored really being totally honest probably about who I was as falling in love, you know, and just, like, suppressed. But that made me more and more unhappy, especially as, like, you're kind of pushed into fitting this, like, cis-normative lifestyle of, like, you know, husband, wife, kid, cars in the garage.
It's weird how powerful that is.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, my fucking God. Like, the walls would just, like, felt like they were coming in more and more.
When you said you questioned in retrospect, you know, trying to understand what falling in love meant... Now, has your sexual orientation always been towards women?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And still?
Mm-hmm.
So that must be...
I mean, that's not to say I haven't made out with a couple guys or anything like that.
No, I know, but I'm just like, in terms of, and I'm not, it's not a judgment thing. It's just like, I'm just wondering where the fight was. Mm-hmm. Like when you say you fell in love with her and you sort of question whether or not that was a sort of like, you know, whether it was earnest or not. Or whether you just subconsciously trying to fit into something. I just wondered what the whole dynamics of that would be. But you just...
Well, because you're just being, you're existing. And at the time too, especially, like, I mean, you have to realize that I probably didn't hear the word transgender until I was like maybe even 26 or 27.
It's pretty new for everybody,
right? Right.
I think.
So like, I didn't understand myself. It's not like I was carrying around. I still don't fucking understand myself. But it's not like I was carrying around full knowledge of like, this is who I am and I have to hide this from everybody. It was like, oh my God, I have all these feelings that are tearing me apart inside, and I don't know how to reconcile them with life and what I'm doing and who I am, you know, and like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. The idea of transitioning even like was a far off concept that I'd only ever like, you know, maybe heard about once or twice.
I think we're all, you know, like from my, where I'm sitting, you know, I am not like, I'm 51 years old. So I missed the movement in a way. Mm-hmm. Of the trans movement. I mean, I knew it existed, but now it's like really, you know, in the forefront of you know, gender politics and also the gender discussion.
Totally.
In this country. And I'm still like an old man when it like, you know, I had to be schooled on the word tranny. Uh-huh. Yeah. And you know, and then I, you know, I talked to RuPaul, who loves that word, but like, I understand.
It's a very like divisive word.
No, I know. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I get why. Mm-hmm. And like, and I'm in no position necessarily to use that. Well, I don't need to use that word, you know, but RuPaul can.
Right.
Uh-huh. You know, but, all right, so now you're married, and now these feelings are becoming oppressive and, mm-hmm. and completely uncomfortable. So do you tell your wife?
I did. I came out, yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, what does that mean? That you, when you come out like that, what do you say?
Well, like, I went, you know, like, I dealt with these feelings to the point where I was like, this isn't going away, you know? So I was like...
What is it? I need to be a woman. Or I need to.
Yeah, like, right. Just like, you know, transitioning.
Right.
The idea of whatever that meant, of like coming out with the way I felt.
Right.
And
okay.
Saying like, look, I'm transgender, or I'm a transsexual. This is the way I feel. I want to transition. I don't know what that means, but I want to transition. Like, I mean, the level of information out there was like pretty like... It's like YouTube testimonial videos, you know, like a couple fucking lo-fi websites that like point you in directions, you know? And I was like living in LA at the time, like staying up, like watching these testimonial videos.
Right, right.
And it's like, okay, yeah, I think you can get on hormones, you know? Like, okay, there's doctors that can do surgeries. Like, I don't fucking know where to turn to,
so
you know?
Like, but you were like, you were sort of like, I, you know, I gotta start this.
Yeah, I mean,
and what'd your wife say?
I, you know, she said, okay, like, that's okay. You know, like, I just came out to her and said, like, I'm a transsexual. I want to transition. And I don't, she didn't know what that
meant.
But
had you been a practicing transsexual?
What does that mean? Practicing? I'm practicing my transsexualism.
Well, I mean,
nightly.
Did you, I guess I mean, like, did you dress, you know, did you find comfort?
Dress in femme? Sure. Yeah. And totally. And like that, but like, I have a lifestyle that like, I spend a lot of time alone. And sometimes I'm like really by myself. Like when I'm working with a band, producing a record, and I'm living in a hotel room, or I'm on tour, I have a really separate life from that. So it was like, I was living two lives.
Yeah.
I was fucking living half a life in a hotel room. And when I was in a hotel room, I was, you know, expressing the way I felt. I was her, or whatever.
You're putting on makeup and like dressing in like wearing the clothes.
yeah, dressing, wearing the clothes. Yeah, yeah. Wearing women's clothes, yeah. Mark. Yeah. Yeah, but it was, it's
I'm
fucked
not
up.
Shy.
No, but it's a terrible experience like, yeah. That because, you know, you're in this like stupid fucking high stress situation where you're like, okay, you know, I got to go into some shitty department store to buy clothes that I don't even want to wear really because it's not my style, but this is the only way I can fucking like relax and
really
express this fucking like way I feel, to calm this like tension,
wow.
That I feel inside of me, because otherwise I'm gonna fucking like snap on someone and just
really?
Lose it, you know?
That's profound. So, and then I guess what you're saying is that because you were living this separate life, and it was like really limited to these hotel rooms when you were working, that it's hard not to associate that with the idea of shame.
Well, yeah, I mean, you feel like you're almost having an affair and you are hiding something, you
right.
know? And it's like, why can't I just fucking be who I am whenever I want to be who I am, you
so
know,
you're
in
this hotel
home.
Right. So you're in this hotel room losing your mind and you're like, I just need to, like, what pieces of clothing would be the most comforting?
What pieces of clothing?
It's like, well, you go to a department store, and what, do you buy a dress? Do you buy a robe? Do you buy some panties? What do you do?
Panties is a gross word. I don't know.
Underwear.
Isn't it a gross word? You just, like, whatever. Fucking even, like, a fucking woman's cut shirt. A woman's cut tank
top. And you,
like, anything to express femininity.
Yeah, and
you know?
Then you'd feel like, better. Like, you'd be like, ugh.
Yeah, I feel like, okay, I'm like expressing the way I feel, even though it's like a weird, fucked up version of it.
Right.
It's not like that was even more dysphoric than just being as I am now.
But,
you know, that changes the experience being out with it. Now it's a totally different thing. It's not like I get off by going to a fucking department store buying panties and soap
going to a hotel room
and then fucking going to a hotel and rubbing them or
right.
something.
I didn't think that to begin with, but it was really the idea of, because I think everyone or most people deal with a discomfort that seems like it can't be resolved.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you were able to address it so specifically and have to reckon with that and not feel ashamed of it or feel like a freak for it, other than the idea that you were hiding something. You know, it's a big step.
Right.
Obviously. And to realize you had to take it, and then to take it is, you know, it's big, because I think that, you know, a lot of people that have the same feelings just die with them.
Mm-hmm.
That's, right.
That's the case. I mean, well, if you look at suicide statistics among the transgender community, you know, it's like something like 50% at least attempt, you know?
It's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't.
No, but I've been slowly trying to kill myself for the past 34 years with alcohol and drugs as a result of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I feel like that was the unhealthy
side.
So
you don't do any drugs or alcohol anymore?
I do, but I mean, now it's like...
Now it's just fun now?
No, seriously, it is. Now it's just recreational and not fucking dysphoria in, like, related, you know?
Yeah, I guess. Okay. If you say so. you'll deal with that other shit later,
Let's do a part two to this podcast.
Yeah, I'll talk to you in a few years. See how your happy-go-lucky drug use...
I'm just talking about smoking a little weed.
There's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But the lyrics in this fucking record, you know, deals with all that. You deal with the suicidal, you know, with the suicide of people that can't live with it or whatever.
Right.
And you deal with your own sort of wrestling with it. You deal with the, and I always assume that people write these from first person.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, the idea of being totally closeted and being a bully is in this record. And then the discomfort, the first song, like, is really the transgender, the title song, Dysphoria Blues, is like that. To me, it's a powerful fucking song, man.
Well, that's talking about like that experience, you know, going into those department stores or going into, like, you know, whatever store when you're perceived as male and you're buying something and the red cash register is looking at you like, you're disgusting. You know, like, they don't even want to take the money out of your hand.
But what about now? I thought, like, some of that song had to do with...
I mean, that's not... It's not like that's gone.
Right. Like, the idea that you have to, you know, you have to honor yourself and you have to honor your feelings and be who you need to be, but you cannot escape the judgment of being physically who you are of other people.
Right. But by owning it, like, I've been able to, like, feel a lot more comfortable and confident in a fuck you way, in a punk rock way of, like, okay, when you're hiding it, you feel shameful, and that in turn makes you feel defensive and closed off, as opposed to being open about it and just being out there and being like, look, I am who I am, you know, like, you may not fully understand that, and I don't really care, but I am who I am, and I have a right to be here, I have a right to shop in this store, I have a right to do this, do that, do whatever I want to do, and I don't have to explain it to you or justify it to you.
Right.
I'm just gonna do it.
Right.
And if you have a problem...
Yeah, I get it. Fuck you.
Yeah.
It's your problem.
It's your problem.
I hope you can deal with that problem.
Yeah. You know, whereas before you felt scared, and I didn't want to feel scared, you know?
Well, it's easy to feel scared if you're going, like, you want to be understood on your own terms and not misunderstood because you're caught doing something.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, because then you're all of a sudden you're in that weird explaining yourself position.
Right. Like, and that was something I thought about too, having a kid, where I was like, what, am I going to be like 50, 60 years old and I'm going to get caught and, like,
yeah,
you know, like, be in that? Like, I don't want that situation, you know?
Well, how old's the kid?
My daughter is now 5.
And how is that all with the ex and stuff?
We're not in a good spot. not really, you know.
But
we
what
don't
did
really
did
talk.
Did but did the separation have to do with you actually, you know, engaging in the transition process? I mean, was it something she couldn't handle? And then like...
No, I mean, I think it's all on me. You know, like, I had a suicidal nervous breakdown about a year after coming out, and I just, like, dissolved as a person, you know? I would, like, really...
But you didn't attempt suicide?
I did, yeah.
Well, how?
How?
Yeah.
Pills and alcohol.
Yeah, classic.
Well, you know, go with the classics. Yeah.
But this is a year in, a year after you came out.
Mm-hmm.
And what broke apart inside you?
It was a combination of things. You know, there was the mental side where, like, I legitimately lost the foundation of why I was transitioning, because I saw that my marriage had, like, gotten so far away from me, because I had been, like, I was scared, you know, was working on a record, transitioning publicly. I had a studio, so I was just, like, locking myself in my studio 10 yeah. hours a day working on a record, which I legitimately needed to do.
Was it this record?
Yeah, yeah. But also I was hiding, you know, like,
yeah.
and then realizing, like, my marriage had fallen apart, and just, like, that crushed me. But then at the same time, too, I started having, like, this weird reaction to the hormone replacement therapy I was on. And so it turned out, once I moved to Chicago and I got medical help, that I had been living with a parasitic infection in my intestines. And so at the time, I had been on estrogen, progesterone, and spironolactone. And so apparently the progesterone had been converting into prednisone, which was causing these, like, crazy hot flashes. And I was, like, waking up in the middle of the night, and, like, my arms would be clenched to my chest, and I couldn't take them down. And I would be, like, burning with sweat, take a shower, come out, and it'd be like 60 degrees in the hotel room. And I was just messed up. Mm-hmm. And living in Florida, going through transition, you know, like, it's just totally different than other places where there was, like, one doctor I could see, one therapist I could see dealing with gender. And so I called the endocrinologist I was dealing with. This was in June at the time.
Yeah.
And they're like, the soonest you can be seen is August. So it was just, like, terrible healthcare. I was in a bad situation and had to, and was really messed up, you know, and it all kind of, like, was a perfect storm. Like, a tree fell through the roof of my studio too and destroyed it. My bass player quit. My drummer had already quit. Like, I was just...
Why'd they quit?
Various reasons. Yeah, I mean, like, really, the drummer and the bass player are totally separate things. The drummer is just kind of a jerk. And the bass player was a dear friend. Time for him to move on, unrelated to that, you know? Like, uh-huh. like that's the tough thing going through a lot of this stuff, even in relation to my ex. Of that's obviously what it seems like then is, like, you defer to the fact of, like, oh, you're transitioning. Is it related to that? Why, like, certain things fell apart? Sometimes I wonder about that, but at the same time, like, it did set off a chain of, like, a bunch of changes are now going to take place within your life, you know? And a lot of that is just the way it is in life. And
it's
all
a reasonable
of a sudden
question,
things
though.
Start to move. Yeah, yeah, it is. But and I don't mind taking, like, I don't mind accepting all the blame for anything. I just would hate to ever put blame or put any kind of guilt on someone else.
If you didn't know that,
yeah,
for sure, that,
you know,
that's,
like,
what they were reacting to.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I can't say that about
right.
anyone.
Sure.
And if they do feel that way, then that's fine and fair, and that's totally cool. But I would hate for them to ever feel guilt for
right.
feeling anything like that.
Right, right, right. So you're empathetic to the struggle that they may have within themselves.
Totally. Everyone processes, like, you know, the news of someone coming out in that way, in a different way, I think, you know?
Well, I think that it's like, you know, coming out in this way, you know, is a relatively newish thing, you know, because I, like you said, I mean, I don't know that, you know, everywhere you can just make this decision and enact it. I mean, coming out as a gay person, I mean, that's sort of been around a while.
Right.
But, you know, something sort of like, because there's more to understand, I would think, for some people. I'm like, wait, so how far is this going to go? When, you know, what is it? How are you oriented? Like, there's other questions. If someone says, I'm gay, they're like, oh, okay. So that's what you are then. But this is, you know, a little more complicated in a way.
I think in a way, though, that also those questions, which are really heavily placed on you when you first come out,
yeah.
can often, like, create this pressure on a trans person that's unrealistic, because you're asking someone who's trans to explain something they don't understand totally. They're just taking a step and they're saying, I identify in a way that's different than you probably identify. We're going to
yeah.
call that trans.
Okay.
Now I'm taking the step to figuring out what that means and figuring out what I want to do. Maybe that means hormone replacement therapy. Maybe that means eventual surgeries.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always have to.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
So placing this pressure to, like, you have to give an answer now. You're going to get surgery? You're going on hormones? What are you going to do? You know, like,
yeah, yeah.
It creates this, like, mind fuck of a pressure, like, cooker where you're just like, right. I don't know.
I don't know.
And just... especially when you do it publicly and you're, like, doing interviews and, yeah. and people want to, you have to have, like, this so that set of answers.
So that happens.
That was pressure, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that contributed to the breakdown.
I think so.
Like, yeah. You're like, oh, well, should I know the answer to these questions? Do I need to do it to appease them?
Yeah, it gets in your head where you're like, what?
Gotta go all the way.
I don't. What am I doing as that's reactionary, or what am I doing because I need to fit into someone else's understanding of an interpretation of gender, or what am I doing because it actually makes me feel more right in my body?
Right.
That's hard to do in the public eye. That's hard to do out of the public eye. That's hard to do in general.
Sure. It's just it's interesting to me because I have my own. Like I don't know how to talk about it. I'd imagine that most people don't want to talk about it. So
this is the best way to talk about it, right. Though, I think.
No, absolutely. But like, I'd imagine the reactionary kind of like sensationalizing thing in a conversation publicly about this in a press situation, they may not be trying to be sensationalistic. They're just sort of like, what's happening? You know, what are you going to do now? Do you have a vagina? When does that happen? Is that, what year does it, is it in progress? I mean... Like, I think there's a fascination that may or may not come from the right place,
mm-hmm.
but it's still there.
Right.
And I never really, I guess, the empathy necessary for the culture to sort of understand that you don't have those answers is a new thing.
Totally.
It's interesting. This is new shit.
It's a brave new world.
It is.
Uh-huh.
Like, because I go up, like, I've made bad jokes before in my life, but sometimes I think that in order for a culture to transition with you,
uh-huh.
you know, you a lot of times people are just laughing because they're uncomfortable.
Sure, that's a legitimate, like, response that happens,
yeah,
you know, and right. It's a much better one than violence.
Right, you know, or fuck you, or immediate boxing of the person.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a sign of internalized transphobia that you've been ingrained with by growing up in a society that is... transphobic, you know, that's taught to you, that's yeah. taught to me, that's what like instilled, that's how I knew without, it wasn't like my parents sat me down one day and they were like, don't be transsexual, all right?
Yeah, that wasn't like, even on the menu.
Right, so you learn about it because you see like, oh, sensationalized like headlines in like supermarket stands, oh, Silence of the Lambs, oh, like Ace Ventura, oh, like, you know, all these things are thrown at you where it's usually the butt of the joke, it's a scary thing, it's obviously an unacceptable thing, it's a laughable thing most of the time.
But it's
so
also,
that's just instilled in you too.
Yeah, but also the thing that cuts through all that, I mean, you know, I think more than... you know, whatever values someone might have or whatever ideas or expectations they might have, it confronts their sexuality.
That's like part of it why, you know, it's a conversation I've had with a friend of mine specifically in regards to transgender women,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the levels of violence that you know, like they're subject to often. And like, why is it a violent reaction? And it has to do with, if, you know, whether or not it challenges your sexuality of like, so you look at a woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you check her out and then you realize maybe, oh shit, that woman has a dick, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that challenges your sexuality. Why, right? But also, like, you're looking woman because it's a sexist, patriarchal society.
Right.
And that's most men's immediate thing they do when they look at a woman.
But
you know,
I'm not
they're,
saying...
like, checking her out. And then they realize, like, oh, this person doesn't fit what I thought they fit. And now this somehow is an affront to my sexuality.
But it does sort of provoke something where it's sort of like it's initially confusing. And if feelings happen within somebody, you know, how they're going to interpret them. Like, there's it's a new experience.
Mm-hmm.
That is sexual.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in that context, it's a sexual experience. Yeah. But I'm saying that the root of that
yeah.
has to do with more of like that it's a sexist society.
Sure.
And that's the way it works.
Sure.
But I also say to back up for a second or on a related note or whatever, too, if you look at the number of people looking at transsexual porn on the internet, it's cis men. You know, like those are the people who are looking at transsexual porn are straight men.
Sure.
You know, like, so what yeah. does that say then, too?
Yeah.
That it's okay to do it in the closet, but if you're caught doing it in real life, then you like it's.
I don't know if I'd assume that they're all closeted because they're watching that porn. There might not be.
I'm just saying they don't know how to interpret what they're feeling. You know, they don't realize that they're attracted to that person because they're a woman, despite the fact that their genitals might right. be a little different than another woman's. But in my experience, with all the women that I've slept with. they all have pretty different pussies or fucking whatever.
Sure.
You know, like
they do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same with cocks.
There you go. You know.
What was the point of getting into that?
I don't remember. Yeah. We were just riffing, I thought.
But so where are you at with the whole thing?
With the whole thing? I don't know.
Am
I'm
not
just living.
Right?
No, I don't know. I'm just living. You know, so I feel in a good place.
But like, in the treatments and like, how does it, you know, where'd you level off? I mean, you went through, you had the nervous breakdown, you were on medicine and hormones and estrogen that were not balanced properly. Is that something, you know, as you transition that you wean yourself off of? Do you hit a level with it?
No.
Do you have to continue taking these pills?
I mean, it depends on who you go to. But like, so there was the level I was getting of healthcare in Florida. When I moved to Chicago, Chicago's informed consent, where you can go into a doctor, say, this is what I'm doing, and you get access to hormones. Uh-huh. Got much better healthcare in Chicago, and then I've been on injectables since I've lived in Chicago.
And that's something you have to just keep doing?
Yeah, once a week, you give yourself a shot.
Mm-hmm. And you're leveled off with the process now?
I don't know. You're good. I mean, I feel way more comfortable about myself. I'm happy. I'm doing what I'm doing. It's really hard to transition when you tour. Like traveling, it's hard for me to get refills of prescription. You know, like it's hard for me to make appointments to go through things like electrolysis. You know, I don't know. Like all this stuff is stuff I think about constantly. It's not like all of a sudden I was like, and on, you know, like
no,
I'm
but
just,
like
you, I'm
but,
just doing me.
But do you feel like you now that you're into it? Like what has it been? 2 years?
2012 is when I came out.
So right? 3 years.
2013. I don't even
but
remember.
Since you've actively been doing the therapies to transition, it's been like 3 years.
Yeah.
Now, are you feeling like, I guess my question is around, you know, what you were freaking out about before in terms of the questions, you know, like now that you've sort of started this thing, are you like, oh, okay, or are you looking to do more?
I feel like that I have a much better understanding of what I need and what makes me feel right than I did 3 years ago. Certainly more than I did 10 years ago,
right.
20 years ago.
Right.
But I feel like that in another 3 years, another 4 years, another 5 years, I will even have an even better understanding of who I am and what I need.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that that's something that you can ever fully feel like complete with or anything like
really?
That. Or at least for me.
Huh. Okay. I guess so. I mean, but that's sort of like to me, like it's sort of like with drugs or something like that, or that feeling of not being complete in other ways, you know, like that is there something, are you doing anything else around the psychology of dysphoria that isn't, you know, transition related? Did you ever address other issues to your discomfort mentally or?
I'm trying to, you know, like I am an existentialist, you know, and I oftentimes feel locked in thinking about things and thinking about the bigger picture of things and what certain things mean. And, you know, I don't know how to reconcile with my life beyond where my tour dates end.
Yeah.
And that's like, I live a really weird life.
I know, but like well, what if you were to quiet it down? I mean, what do you, like, I'm a recovery guy. So I haven't done shit in like 15, 16 years. You know, that was my problem.
Right.
But do I feel whole and complete all the time? No, I feel better about myself. I feel comfortable in my skin, but there's still something like, you know, what does it all mean? What's the fucking point?
Yeah.
So, you know, that hasn't gone away.
No, I very much still have that. Yeah. That's there. I don't want that to go away in a way, you know?
Like, I know.
I think that's healthy.
Sure it is. Yeah, but you should have some peace of mind.
Yeah. I mean, it's a trip, you know, like.
And I can't imagine. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I can't imagine that, like, it took me, like, you know, years. Like, I don't think I arrived in my body until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, just, you know, when I started to get successful and feel like that I'd worked very hard all my life to do something. It was a self-esteem problem.
Sure.
You know, and it sort of happened organically, but I felt it happen. So I imagine on some level that, you know, you taking this, you know, this making this transition has given you some of that. I mean, your self-esteem must be better and your comfort
100%,
level.
100%. Yeah. My problems now, I guess, are more just like normal problems of like, oh, I'm going through another divorce, you know? And like, oh, I got to deal with the fact that like I work and I travel and I have a kid, and how do I balance like traveling life with having a kid and being able to be a part of my kid's life when I'm not necessarily getting along with the mother, you know, like those are just like the realities of life that everyone has. Those are minimal problems to what other people's problems are. You know, I have it really good in that I enjoy what I do. I really love playing music. I really love traveling.
How's the community responded to all this?
You mean the community as in like music community?
The punks.
The punks have been really supportive and really cool.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. 100%.
No dicks?
There's been some dicks, but I mean, there's always a couple dicks, and then
but it, like people
anybody, don't read the comments, but you know,
no, but I mean bigger dicks. I mean, like, are there any? Is there? Have you had any experience with people that you respected, or other musicians that have reacted poorly?
No,
that's good.
No, uh-uh.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it's been really surprising, you know.
Yeah,
in a great way.
And the bandmates.
Bandmates, totally cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really not that big of a deal, I think, is what most people like get after a second. They're just like, oh, okay, you just like would prefer me to use feminine pronouns with you, and then we're going to practice at the same time, and we're going to go on tour, and we'll hang out and have a fun time, and you still have the same sense of humor, right, and like the same things.
And you just look a little more ladylike.
Yeah, and cool. That's what we're doing, you know? Like, great. Easy.
Do you get attention from men?
What do you mean?
I mean sexual attention since you've like transitioned this much.
I guess. I don't
Come
know.
Come on. You want to look sexy, don't you? Sometimes you want to look pretty, don't you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like, I liked, you know, I'm the singer in a band. I'm a little bit like arrogant and vain too, where I think like everyone maybe has a thing for me to a certain extent. So well, I guess that's the way I carry myself through the world, right?
Right. You know? Well, that's good. I think that's a good rock and roll position to have.
Right.
All right. So the new record's done. You're touring on this record. Uh-huh. And you're big. Like, I didn't, like, you know, I feel bad because I'm so out of the loop. But, I mean, you have a big following. You're a popular band.
We have a modest following that I'm very happy with. And I really like our fans.
Believe me, I understand. I have a modest following as well.
Wasn't that modest of me?
It was pretty good. But how's your ego? Do you want more? Do you always want more? Do you want to be big? Do you want a stadium rock?
Or what do you want to do? Everyone does. And especially like you want
I don't. It makes me paralyzed with fear to try to. Well, I'm a stand up though, and it's very personal in a way that, you know, that's just me up there. So the idea of me performing for 10,000 people, it's sort of like, what could they want from me?
Honestly, like, I'm happy that anyone wants to see me. I mean that, like, genuinely. Of course, like, you want to feel like you're progressing and doing new things. Mm. And I don't want to feel like I'm just playing the same club over and over and over again, you know, and that it's never changing. So you do want to feel like growth. That's, like, natural, I feel like, and a healthy thing.
Sure.
And ambition is a good thing.
Sure.
And wanting to feel like you're reaching more people, especially it's so hard in the music industry these days where things are so skewed, where it's like, you know, like each record we've sold or each record we put out, last three records has charted higher,
yeah,
but like ultimately sold less. You know what I mean? Like it sold less for
sure,
week, but the chart position is higher, so like you know, you want some sign that you're still relevant in the music industry. I don't know.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's just about the people who come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sales are tricky, you know. I've only really talked to I've talked to some, you know, big old dudes, you know, musician wise, and a few young dudes, but the only other real like honest punk that I talked to was, you know, Patrick Stickles from Titus Andronicus.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's a piece of work. But like, you know, it seems like you guys, I mean, in a good way. He's something. But like, it seems like, you know, when you're at the level you're at, it's just about touring constantly.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But that's what we've always been. You know, we've always been a band that was about
And you've got original guys with you still?
My best friend James, who I met on the first day of high school, is my guitar player still to this day. So, yeah.
That's sweet. And you get along. And Fat Mike plays on your records?
He played a couple songs on that record, on Transgender Dysphoria Blues, yeah.
It's a good record.
Thank you.
And what about, like, how's your mom handling all this?
My mom's great. She's been really supportive. And
from the get-go?
Yeah.
Did she experience concern initially?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, like, I mean, she's a mom.
Yeah.
She worries. She's a parent.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think she was just wants me to be happy, ultimately.
Yeah, that is what they want. You think? I think so. I would hope that. And your brother?
My brother's totally cool.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Just the dad. He might not come around.
I hope, maybe. I don't know, you know? I don't know how to do that. That was complicated regardless of gender dysphoria.
Do you visualize anything? I mean, do you want something? What do you want?
I feel like that even though I'm 34 years old, that I'm still allowed to be the kid, and that if they're the parent, that, you know, come to me. Like,
okay,
so be my parent.
You're going to hold out.
I am.
Okay. right. Well, we'll see what happens. And check back in.
Yeah.
Nice talking to you.
You too.
That's it. That's the show. I loved it. I love her, and I liked her music. I hope you enjoyed that conversation, the talk. Hope you dug the talk. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod needs. Check the calendar. Boulder dates are coming up fast, and Denver dates are coming up fast. That's Boulder, July 24th at the Boulder Theater in Boulder, Colorado, and Denver, July 25th at the Paramount Theater in Denver, Colorado. Portland this weekend is sold out. Thank you. On Thursday, I'll be talking to Ed Asner. And also, we'll have a little shorty with Adam Goldberg, which was fun. So look forward to that.